Hello, everyone. I'm Kamran.
And I'm Billy. Welcome to the Horse Frog Podcast, home of your two favorite professional digressors.
Today, we will be discussing Book 3, Chapter 14 of Deadhouse Gates, a novel in the Malazan Book of the Fallen.
Now, this podcast series is intended to be a companion to reading or listening to the books set in the Malazan universe. It's not a book review, and it's most definitely not intended to be a replacement to reading the books. Know that Kamran and I know that this series is the best fantasy story ever written, and we're approaching this from a purely fanboy point of view. There's not going to be any critique, just marveling at Mr. Erickson's major works here.
We'll be covering the events of the books in a linear fashion. There will be spoilers for those that have not read the books. We'll try not to spoil anything prior to us covering that portion of the respective book.
A quick warning, today's episode contains descriptions of extreme violence.
Does it?
Does it? It has some troubling stuff. Moderately strange stuff if you are a rat-a-phobe.
Oh, no, you're right. It does have extreme violence. I'm sorry. I stand corrected. Okay, go ahead.
So it has descriptions of extreme violence, not recommended for children, unless you're looking to screw your kids up, and no judgment here. Probably should be, but not.
Our show is listener-supported. If you'd like to support us, we'd really appreciate it. You can do so by visiting our Patreon link on our website at horsefrogproductions.com. Currently, we are posting ad-free episodes on Patreon weekly.
Also, we would really like to hear from you, so send any feedback or comments you have to contact@horsefrogproductions.com.
All right, Chapter 14. The chapter begins with Felicin, Culp, and Hebrick. Last we saw them, they were in the belly of a city from the First Empire. The city was beneath a mesa, and the group found a hidden garden which contained a pool of water which had healing properties. Culp said, "We can't stay here." Felicin's eyes narrowed on him. She asked, "Why not? That storm outside will kill us. There's no sheltering from it, except here, where there's water, food." Culp snapped, "Because we're being hunted." From where he sat against a wall, Hebrick laughed. He raised his invisible hands and said, "Show me a mortal who is not pursued, and I'll show you a corpse. Every hunter is hunted. Every mind that knows itself has stalkers. We drive and are driven. The unknown pursues the ignorant. The truth assails every scholar wise enough to know his own ignorance, for that is the meaning of unknowable truths." This took me some time to process, as it's very philosophical.
Yeah.
I like the idea that people wise enough to know their own ignorance are assailed by the truth. As long as they're willing to look for it, they'll find it.
Yeah, I agree. But you have to really take that look and realize that we are woefully ignorant.
I mean, there's just so much to know. And then it's becoming increasingly difficult to know what the truth is online, given how easy it is with AI to create fake stuff nowadays.
Oh, I know it. That's pretty crazy.
Culp looked up from where he sat and studied Hebrick. He said, "I was speaking literally. There are living shapeshifters in this city. Their scent rides every wind, and it's getting stronger." Felicin asked, "Why don't we just give up?" Culp sneered. Felicin said, "I'm not being flippant. We're in Raraku, the home of the whirlwind. There won't be a friendly face within 100 leagues of here. Not that there's a chance of making it that far in any case." Hebrick added, "And the faces closer at hand aren't even human. Every mask unveiled. And you know, the presence of divers and soul taken is most likely not at the whirlwind's beckoning. All a tragic coincidence, this year of Dryzhna and the unholy convergence." Culp said, "You're a fool if you think that. The timing is anything but accidental. I've a hunch that someone started those shapeshifters on that convergence, and that someone acted precisely because of the uprising. Or it went the other way around. The whirlwind goddess guided the prophecy to ensure that the year of Dryzhna was now, when the convergence was underway, in the interest of creating chaos within the warrens." Hebrick slowly nodded and said, "Interesting notions, mage. Natural, of course, coming from a practitioner of Mianus, where deceit breeds like runaway weeds and inevitably defines the rules of the game, but only when useful." Felicin stayed silent, watching the two men. She thought, "One conversation, here on the surface, yet another beneath. The priest and the mage are playing games, the entwining of suspicion with knowledge. Hebrick sees a pattern. His plundering of ghostly lives gave him what he needed. And I think he's telling Culp that the mage himself is closer to that pattern than he might imagine. Here, wielder of Mianus, take my invisible hand." Felicin decided she had had enough. She asked, "What do you know, Hebrick?" Hebrick shrugged. Culp growled, "Why does it matter to you, lass? You're suggesting surrender. Let the shapeshifters take us. We're dead anyway." Felicin said, "I asked, why do we struggle on? Why leave here? We haven't got a chance out in the desert." Culp rose. He snapped, "Stay then. Hood knows you've nothing useful to offer." Felicin said, "I've heard all it takes is a bite." Culp went still and slowly turned to her. He said, "You heard wrong. It's common enough ignorance, I suppose. A bite can poison you, a cyclical fever of madness, but you do not become a shapeshifter." Felicin asked, "Really? Then how are they created?" Culp said, "They aren't. They're born." Hebert clambered to his feet and said, "If we're to walk through this dead city, let us do so now. The voices have stilled, and I am clear of mind." Felicin demanded, "What difference does that make?" Hebrick said, "I can guide us on the swiftest route, lass, else we wander lost until the ones who hunt us finally arrive." They drank one last time from the pool, then gathered as many of the pale fruits as they could carry. Felicin had to admit to herself that she felt healthier, more mended, than she had in a long time, as if memories no longer bled and she was left with naught but scars. Yet the cast of her mind remained fraught. She had run out of hope. Hebrick led them swiftly down tortuous streets and alleys, through houses and buildings, and everywhere they went, they trod over and around bodies, human, shapeshifter, and Talani mass, ancient scenes of fierce battle. Hebrick's plundered knowledge was lodged in Felicin's mind. She felt she was close to grasping a profound truth, around which orbited all human endeavor since the very beginning of existence. She thought, "We do not but scratch the world, frail and fraught. Every vast drama of civilizations, of peoples with their certainties and gestures, means nothing, affects nothing. Life crawls on, ever on." She wondered if the gift of discovering the meaning underlying humanity offered nothing more than a devastating sense of futility. It's the ignorant who find a cause and cling to it, for within that is the illusion of significance. Faith, a king, queen, or emperor, or vengeance, all the bastion of fools. I think that's a pretty defeatist way to look at life. I mean, sure, we can look at the cyclical nature of human civilization and throw up our hands knowing that it will crumble and then come back again. Having a cause can help provide a purpose and beat back the negative waves that come from thinking this way.
Don't hit me with them negative waves so early in the morning. Don't you dig how beautiful this day is? Let you say something righteous and hopeful for a change. I'm sorry. Oh, that's too good.
Do you agree that it's probably better to not think about it in that fashion and look at the brighter side of life?
Well, being an optimist, yes, that I am. I'm always the guy that's going to pick. Yes, I'm going to pick the let's try to look for the bright side here.
Yeah, I spent the better part of my life being a pessimist, and I've kind of rewired the way I think about things over the last couple of years. And it's definitely a better way to live for me personally. I'll tell you that.
Oh, absolutely. Having something to live for, to hope for, you know, is it provides a lot of peace in your life, a lot of comfort. It provides stability. I think it adds some foundation for you, I believe, to be more stable.
I think we'll come to a quote later in this chapter where I'll come back to this.
Yes.
Because I just made that connection right now.
Okay.
The wind moaned at their backs, and it carried in it a faint scent of spice.
Spice.
That was bait. I put some skank on it, by the way.
I should have known that's what that was, but I resisted for a second.
No, it's good. It's good. Felicin judged an hour had passed before Hebrick paused. They stood before the grand entrance to a temple of some kind, where the columns, squat and broad, had been carved into a semblance of tree trunks. A frieze ran beneath the cracked, sagging plinth, each panel a framed image which Culp's warren cast light eerily lit from beneath. Culp was staring up at the images. "Hood's breath," he mouthed. Hebrick was smiling. Culp said, "It's a deck," Felicin thought. Yet another pathetic assertion of order. Hebrick nodded. "The elder deck, aye. Not houses, but holds. Realms. Can you discern death and life? And dark and light? Do you see the hold of the beast, who sits upon the antlered throne, Culp?" Culp said, "It's empty, assuming I'm looking at the one you mean. The frame displays various creatures. The throne is flanked by Talani mass." Hebrick said, "Aye, that is the one. No one on the throne, you say. Curious." Culp asked, "Why?" Hebrick said, "Because every echo of memory tells me there used to be." Culp grunted. "Well, it's not been defaced. You can see the back of the throne, and it looks as weathered as everywhere else." Hebrick said, "There should be the unaligned. Can you detect those?" Culp said, "No. Perhaps around the sides and back?" Hebrick said, "Possibly. Among them, you'll find Shapeshifter. Felicin drawled, all very fascinating. I take it we're to enter this place, since that's where the wind is going. Hebrick smiled and said, aye, the far end shall provide our exit. This temple is so similar to the one that Ikarim and Mappo found beneath Tessim earlier in the book, right down to the carved tree trunks. It's the same civilization, probably, right?
Yeah. Supposed first empire, is that what we're saying?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to use air quotes, first empire.
Yes, yes. I was wiggling my fingers off. Well, we don't have cameras, so yes, I was air quoting. So yes. I said first empire as well, yes.
Right, because I think there was a section earlier in the book where someone asserted, it might have been Hebrick,
that was.
This empire called itself the first empire, but the Talan MS might have had something to say about that.
Yes, because I believe that we see a lot of this first empire stuff. And I think that maybe we're supposed to remember back to this quote unquote first empire.
It's easy to conflate all this stuff because, you know, I was getting confused thinking this empire was the Talan MS empire evolved.
Right.
But it's actually a different one.
Yeah. I'm curious, do you think that there is a sense of vagueness on this answer because of the fact that history sometimes is vague on our own kind of history? We just have to kind of work it out ourselves. And do you think Erickson leaves that vaguery there?
Possibly. And maybe. The reason I say that is if you look at the Middle East, the region was old 2,000 years ago. There was civilization several thousand years old that was buried already. They had weather-worn monuments and stuff from civilizations before ancient Persia and the Egyptians and all that. When you have the passage of time like this, it's easy for things to get wiped away and then come back. So I look at this in a similar way.
Okay. That's kind of what I'm doing too. I think that's just, you know what, that's just, I think, one of the masterful things that Mr. Erickson does is just, he leaves things randomly sticking out here and there. Just like you'd find it in the desert, like they're doing right here in this city, and find these weird things. Like, wow, you want to know more about it? We're going to know what we know as we go through here, and then we're going to be past it, and we're never going to come back. You know, and sometimes that's how it is. It adds to that level of, I think that's what adds some, because I, for one, tire of everyone's constant need to have every question answered. You know, with every television show, every form of entertainment, things need to be answered. It's like, no, no, you need to be entertained. You know, you need to be tweaked, peaked, you know, you don't need to be, doesn't, some of the joy is you asking yourself things.
There is a concept of not telling people too much about yourself, and they will assume the best, you know, because they probably think better of you knowing less about you in many cases. Because we all have our downfalls, right? And you haven't failed them yet. So they probably think, oh, yeah, they're proficient in this or that. So maybe it's, I agree with you. It's like, oh, you tantalize the reader with this little bit of information. They're like, oh, my God, this could be this and this and this. And maybe it isn't, but you would never know if it's not answered.
That's right. Again, sometimes it's okay that it's not answered, though.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It lets the reader fill in a lot of the gaps, and it could be your imagination runs wild. Yeah. And if you have an overactive imagination like me, I can think of some pretty epic stuff to fill it in with.
Well, for me in particular, I think I've always told you I'm a huge H.P. Lovecraft fan. And sometimes you find, because he was kind of the what we deem the originator of so-called cosmic horror. And the cosmic horror is finding out these vast infinitudes of time existed and that we're just kind of the nearest folks here on the block. And it was kind of Lovecraft's thing. And he has some things with there's some cities buried out there in the deserts of our world in Lovecraft's universe that are very scary and weird places, but that are very reminiscent in some ways to something here. And that's something that Lovecraft did too, is he had a lot of deliberate vagaries and non-descriptions, because the descriptions, we've talked about this with Erickson himself, not having representations of these races. You know, there's no artwork commissioned because it leaves it to you, the reader, and not to him to dial in what you're looking for. And that's there's something to that.
I agree. The interior of the temple was nothing more than a tunnel, its walls, floor, and ceiling hidden beneath packed layers of sand. The wind raised its voice the farther in they went. 40 paces later, they could discern pale ochre light ahead. The tunnel narrowed, the howling wind making it difficult to resist being pushed forward headlong, and they were forced to duck into a shambling crouch near the exit point. Hebrick held back just before the threshold to let Cult pass, then Felicin. They stood on a ledge, the mouth of a cave high on a cliff face. The wind tore at them as if seeking to cast them out, flinging them into the air, and a fatal drop to the jagged rocks 200 or more arm spans below. Felicin moved to grip one crumbling edge of the cave mouth. The vista had taken her breath away, weakened her knees. The whirlwind raged, not before them, but beneath them, filling the vast basin that was the holy desert. A fine haze of suspended dust drifted above a floor of seething yellow and orange clouds. The sun was an edgeless ball of red fire to the west, deepening its hue as they watched. Can you imagine what that would look like, seeing a sandstorm from just above it? That would be a really cool visual.
Oh, absolutely. You know, do your kids play Breath of the Wild?
Yes.
You've seen the Korok forest that's surrounded by the haze. It's kind of like that almost.
I was picturing it as, you know, that big storm on Jupiter. Like if you were on some type of platform above that, looking down on it, kind of like that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's probably more appropriate. It's a big storm. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. After a long moment, Felicin barked a laugh and said, "All we need now is wings." Hebrick said, "I become useful once again." He grinned as he stepped out to stand beside her. Culp's head whipped around. He asked, "What do you mean?" Hebrick said, "Tie yourselves to my back, both of you. This man's got a pair of hands, and he can use them. And for once, my blindness will prove a salvation." Culp peered down the cliff face. He asked, "Climb down this? It's rotten rock, old man." Hebrick said, "Not the handholds I'll find, mage. Besides, what choice do you have?" Felicin said, "Oh, I simply can't wait." Culp said, "All right, but I'll have my warren open. We'll fall just as far, but the landing will be softer. Not that it'll make much difference, I suppose, but at least it gives us a chance." Hebrick shouted, "You have no faith!" Felicin said, "Thanks for that." She thought, "How far do we have to be pushed? We're not slipping into madness. We're being nudged, tugged, and pulled into it." A hot, solid pressure closed on her shoulder. She turned. Hebrick had laid an invisible hand on her. She could see nothing, yet the thin weave of her shirt's fabric was compressed, slowly darkening with sweat. She could feel its weight. He leaned close and said, "Raraku reshapes all who come to it. This is one truth you can cling to. What you were falls away. What you become is something different." His smile broadened at her snort of disdain. With a sympathetic tone, he said, "Raraku's gifts are harsh, it's true." Culp was readying harnesses. He said, "These straps are rotting." Hebrick swung to him and said, "Then you must hold on tight." Culp said, "This is madness." Felicin thought, "Those were my words." Hebrick asked, "Would you rather await the divers and soul taken?" Culp scowled. Hebrick's body felt like gnarled tree roots. Felicin clung with trembling muscles, not trusting the straining leather straps. Her gaze remained fixed on Hebrick's wrists. The unseen hands themselves were plunging into the rock face, while below she heard his feet scrambling for purchase again and again. Hebrick was carrying the weight of the three of them with his hands and arms alone. Quite an amazing feat, that.
Yes, and this is a core memory here, him climbing down with his hands in that rock face. Just like, it looks like his wrists are in there. That's so weird.
Yeah, it's like the hands are grabbing something inside the rock.
Yeah. Almost. Yeah. And the strength, though, he's just got this new strength that's carrying two other people as well as himself down this cliff face. Like, it's not really a chore.
That is a scary amount of strength.
Yeah.
I know you see it in movies all the time, but you try hanging from one hand at any given time, and it is extremely difficult to do it for any duration. Imagine
absolutely
trying to do it.
I can't. And I can do pull-ups. I mean, I've, you know, I can do about 5-6 pull-ups back to back at my age. And I'm pretty proud of myself for being able to do that. And I can hold myself up quite well for a long time, but not by one hand.
Yeah. That's quite a bit of grip strength there. Granted, he's got...
Yes, he's got the supernatural grip, but he's got the supernatural kung fu grip going on here.
He definitely. Yeah. He's grabbing the chi.
Yeah.
The cliff was bathed in the setting sun's red glare. Felicin thought, as if we're descending into a cauldron of fire, into some demonic realm. And this is a one-way trip. Raraku will claim us, devour us. The sands will bury every dream of vengeance, every desire, every hope. We will all of us drown here in this desert. Wind slapped them against the cliff face, then yanked them outward in a biting swirl of airborne sand. They had entered the whirlwind once again. Culp shouted something lost in the battering roar. Felicin felt herself being pulled away, raised up horizontal by the frantic, hungry wind. She hooked one arm around Hebrick's right shoulder. That is some powerful wind to pull her out like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's really strong. I mean, I can just imagine, I can just visualize her clinging for dear life.
Yes.
Not to be yanked off of this fellow. Mm-hmm. That's while he's climbing down.
Right.
His strength is also allowing him to not be moved by this wind.
To get ripped away from it.
Yeah. So he's strong enough to hold all three of them and to not even look like he's struggling against this wind while she's like, I can imagine her legs like out behind her, her mm-hmm. arms are around his neck or something like that.
Felicin's muscles began shuddering with the strain, her joints burning. She felt the harness straps around her tightening as they slowly assumed the strain. Hopeless, she thought, the gods mock us at every turn. Hebrick continued to climb downward, into the heart of the maelstrom. From inches away, Felicin watched as the blowing sand began abrading the skin stretched over her elbow joint. The sensation was nothing more than that of a cat's tongue, yet the skin was peeling back, vanishing. That is some strong abrasion happening there.
Yeah, right? How long can you stand there before it strips you of your outer layer of skin?
I don't think it would take very long at all.
Not long at all.
Her legs and body rode the wind, and from everywhere she felt the dreadful rasp of the storm's tongue. She thought, I will be nothing but bones and sinew when we reach the bottom. Tottering fleshless with a rictus grin, Felicin unveiled in all her glory. Man... Okay, I gotta interject here for a second.
Okay.
I learned to barbecue. It's this guy, How to Barbecue Right on YouTube.
Okay.
When he pronounces sinew, he says sinew. And man, it gets me every time. He's from Mississippi.
Okay.
Man, I had to stop myself from laughing when I just read that because I thought of the sinew.
That's pretty funny. We got some pretty good sinew here.
Yeah. I'm not sure if everybody in Mississippi says it like that or if that's just
him,
the way he talks. But yeah, his recipes are on point, though. I'll tell you okay. that.
Is it kind of like rednecky or something like that?
Yeah, I would say so.
Not an insult to rednecks, folks. I come from a long line of folks that got a rednecks all running through our family. So I'm a Texas boy. It's just a question. It's a legitimate question.
He's a really friendly guy. Great recipes.
Okay.
Everything I've made of his, everybody has liked.
All right. Good deal. That says a lot.
Hebrick stepped away from the cliff face. The three of them fell in a heap onto a ragged floor of rocks. Felicin screamed as the stones and sand pressed hard against the ravaged skin of her back. She found herself staring back up the cliff, revealed in patches where the gusting sand momentarily thinned. She thought she saw a figure, 50 arm spans above them. Then it was swallowed once more by the storm. Interesting. Who could that be? Culp tugged at the straps with frantic haste. Felicin rolled clear, pushing herself onto her hands and knees. She thought, there's something. Even I can feel it. Culp shouted, on your feet, lass, quickly! Whimpering, Felicin struggled upright. The wind slapped her back down in a lash of pain. Warm hands closed on her, lifted her up in the crook of rope-muscled arms. Hebrick said, life's like that. Hold tight. They were running, leaning into the raging wind. She squeezed shut her eyes. The agony of her flayed skin flashing like lightning behind her eyelids. She thought, Hood, take this, all of it. They stumbled into sudden calm. Culp hissed in surprise. Felicin opened her eyes on a motionless mist of dust, describing a sphere in the midst of the whirlwind. A large, vague shape was tottering toward them through the haze. The air was redolent with citrus perfume. She struggled until Hebrick set her down. Four pale men in rags were carrying a palanquin on which sat, beneath an umbrella, a vast, corpulent figure wearing voluminous silks in a splash of discordant colors. What a sentence that was. But gosh, those words.
Yeah, he gets a lot of 25-cent words here.
Yeah. Slitted eyes peered out from sweat-beaded folds of flesh. The man raised one bloated hand, and the bearers halted. He squealed, Perilous! Join me, strangers, and take leave of yon dangers, a desert filled with beasts of most unpleasant disposition. I offer humble sanctuary through artful sorcery invested into this chair at great personal expense. Do you hunger? Do you thirst? Ah, but look at the wounds upon the frail lass. I possess healing unguents. I would see such a delectable morsel with skin smoothed once again into youthful perfection. Tell me, is she perchance a slave? Might I make an offer? Felicin said, I am not a slave. She thought, and I am no longer for sale. Hebrick whispered, the reek of lemon is making my blind eyes water. I sense greed, but no ill will. Kulp said, nor I, only his porters are undead, not to mention strangely chewed. The stranger said, I see you hesitate, and I applaud caution at all times. I, my servants, have seen better days, but they are harmless, I assure you. Kulp called out, how is it you oppose the whirlwind? The stranger said, not opposed, sir. I am a true believer and most humble. The goddess grants me ease of passage, for which I make constant propitiation. I am not but a merchant. My trade is select merchandise, of the magical kind, that is. I am making my return journey to Pan Potsen, you see, after a lucrative venture of Shaik's rebel camp. The man smiled and went on. I know you as Malazans, and no doubt enemies of the great cause. But cruel retribution finds no root in my soil, I assure you. And truth to tell, I would enjoy your company, for these dread servants are obsessed with their own deaths, and there's no end to their complaints. As I imagine the undead would be.
Oh my word, they would be dreadful company. I mean, if they're not harmful, this is what's funny. I don't want to say anything that spoils, but there are some interesting undead characters in this series. I think that's safely said.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And yes, I can imagine that you would be obsessed with how you died, especially working for this fella.
Oh, yeah. At a gesture, the four bearers set the sedan chair down. Two of them immediately began removing camp gear from the storage rack behind the seat, their movements careless and loose, while the other pair set to levering their master onto his feet. The man wheezed. There is a most potent salve in yon wooden chest there. The one called Nub carries it. Nub, set that down, you nod grub. Nub the grub, hee! Leave off fumbling with the catch. Such nimble escapades will melt your rotting brain. Aye, you've no hands. The man's eyes had found Hebrick as if for the first time. He said, a crime to have done such a thing. Alas, none of my healing unguents could manage such complex regeneration. I'm sorry, I got to do it every time.
I know it. Does this guy kind of remind you of somebody from a previous book?
Kruppa?
Yeah, this is kind of the way he speaks. He's got a very Kruppa-esque vibe to the way he talks, doesn't he?
Yes. He goes on.
Yes. Yes, he did.
I know Kruppa has said that before.
Oh, sure. Yes. Yeah. But just the kind of, you know, oh man, don't mind these guys. You know, they're just the banter. He's got the constant salesman's banter. Mm-hmm. Even though he's not trying to sell anything, he's trying to sell himself, I guess, to these people that he's a nice guy. So that's a job in and of itself, I guess.
I got to tell you, the vibe I'm picking up from these undead, it's like when I'm trying to get my kids to do something they don't want to do, the amount of complaining that's going on and the amount of loose movements that are not precise. Imagine putting your clothes away after we get them out of the dryer. That's just the vibe I'm picking up from these undead servants here.
Oh yeah. But it's more monotone. It's like,
one of my kids is monotone when he's whining like this.
Okay, well then there you go. Does he now have a new nickname? Is he now going to be Grub?
No.
or Nub, I'm sorry.
No. Hebrick said, please do not feel distressed at what I lack, or even at what you lack. I have need for nothing, although this shelter from the wind is most welcome. The man said, yours is assuredly a tragic tale of abandonment, once priest of Fainer, and I shall not pry. And you, the man swung to Kulp, forgive me, the Warren of Mienus, perchance? Kulp's face darkened. He growled, you do more than sell sorcerous trinkets. The man bowed his head. He said, long proximity, kind sir, nothing more. I assure you, I have devoted my life to magery, yet I do not practice it. The years have granted me a certain sensitivity. That is all. My apologies if I gave offense. He reached out and cuffed one of his servants. He said, you, what name did I give you? How callous! just cuffing people left and right.
Well, he is undead, but I mean, just serve it.
They have rights.
Do they? do you forfeit your rights when you're dead? I'm not quite dead. I'm not sure how that works, but
they seem to have some of their mental faculties about sure, them.
They do.
And if that is the case, then yes, they should have rights.
But I'm not sure if the dead or undead have rights. Douglas Adams from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy fame, in book two, there was a guy that was dead for a year for tax reasons. But he was not undead. He was just dead for a year. I'm curious about that too. This implies that we have the technology to bring him back after a year of being dead, paying. I'm kind of curious about that though. But this fellow there, this merchant, has always stayed with me. This is a very big imagery. This part where they first get everything, when they, this book is so chock full of core memory. But something about the city, getting out of the city, climbing down the cliff face, and running just smack dab right away, running to this fella. You know,
this is a very eerie scene to me. I mean, sure, yeah, it's got the comedic relief with him cuffing the servants and yelling at them and stuff like that. But just randomly coming across this guy in the middle of the whirlwind, that's automatically alarm bells going off.
Yes, very much so. And that's why, and I think that's what makes it so eerie. He appears kind of on the surface like Krupp, or someone that we recognize as, that we think is kind of friendly. But yeah, what is he doing here? Why are these guys dead? Mm-hmm. It's like, what's going on here, man?
All good questions.
Yeah, because it's almost closer to horror, even though it's played for comedy.
They're kind of close together sometimes, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
Weren't we talking about that when we were talking about Jordan Peele's movies?
Yes, because Peele's movies in particular, his first one, what's so great about the first one, I find the movie not, it's like, have you ever seen Scorsese's After Hours?
No. But you told me about the premise of it. I think it was like 10 episodes ago. Yeah.
So the idea that you've got this movie that is not funny in the slightest to me until the punchline is delivered at the end. And then the whole thing is like, oh my gosh, that's hilarious. All of a sudden, the whole movie's funny because of that one thing. And that's how After Hours is. Because After Hours has that same horrificness to it until something is said at the very end or seen at the very end. You're like, oh my word, that is hilarious. That is just the fun. It's all of a sudden gone from the most horrific thing you've seen to the saddest, funniest thing you've ever seen. You're right, though. They're all close together.
This scene here that we're about to get into is very reminiscent of the uncomfortable nature of the chimp scenes in Nope. The tension being so high.
Yes.
To me, at least. I don't know if you feel the same way.
I feel the same. I feel the same.
Felicin stared in fascination as the corpse's gnawed lips peeled back in a twisted grin. It said, Clam, though I once knew myself as Irin Thalar. The man said, oh, shut up with what you once knew. You are Clam now. Clam said, I had a horrid death. The man shrieked, shut up! His face suddenly darkened. Clam fell silent. The man gasped, now, find us that Falari wine. Let us celebrate with the Empire's most civil gifts. Clam stumbled off. Its nearest companion's head swiveled to follow with desiccated eyes. It said, yours was not as horrid as mine. The man hissed, the seven holies preserve us. I beg of you, mage, a spell of silence about these ill-chosen animations. I shall pay in Jakarta Imperials and pay well. This guy wasn't lying about these guys being obsessed with their deaths.
Other than his name, do you think it's about all they can remember? The last moments before death?
Maybe.
If it was, it would make you obsess on it, I imagine. That's all you think about.
Good point. Culp muttered, beyond my abilities. Felicin's eyes narrowed on Culp as she thought, that has to be a lie. The man sighed. Ah, well, gods below. I have not yet introduced myself. I am Nawal Ebur, humble merchant of the holy city Penpotsen. And what names do you three wish to be known by? Felicin thought, oddly put. Culp said, I'm Culp. Hebrick said, Hebrick. Felicin said nothing. Nawal said, while the lass is shy. His lips curved into an indulgent smile as he looked upon her. Culp crouched down at the wooden chest, released the catch, and lifted the lid.
I gotta say, I'm kind of proud of Felicin not giving a name. Names are a power, especially in the world of magic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of proud of her. Whether it was done through ignorance or just petulance, still a good thing.
I think she's suspicious.
Yeah, she seems really, she's actually kind of, we may cover this at the end. I'll cover this at the end, but she.
Okay.
We'll cover her later.
Okay. Nawal said, the white clay bowl with the wax seal. The wind was a distant moan, the dust of the calm slowly settling around them. Hebrick, still gifted with an awareness that dispensed with the need for sight, sat down on a boulder. A faint frown wrinkled his broad forehead, and his tattoos were dull beneath a veil of dust. Culp strode to Felicin, the bowl in one hand. He said, it's a healing salve, and potent indeed. Felicin asked, why didn't the wind tear your skin, mage? You've not got Hebrick's protection. Culp said, I don't know, lass. I had my warren open. Perhaps that was enough. Felicin asked, why didn't you extend its influence over me? He glanced away and muttered, I thought I had. Do you believe him? Or did he withhold since she's been so nasty to him?
I think that she is, I think it's the latter. He's just, not the latter, it's the former. I think he's just tired of her, especially because as we got earlier parts, she's mentioned about laying down and dying. So it's like, it could be more of like, you know, hey, you know what? You want it? There you go. I'm not going to bother protecting you.
Okay. There's a possibility that he was also overwhelmed, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. How scary would that be dangling from some guy's back while you can't control anything, but just holding, you can control whether you can fall to your death by holding on to this guy. But that would be very exhausting.
Right. Yeah, I'm kind of in the camp that he was just so overwhelmed with the situation, he probably just protecting himself as best he could at that time.
I thought that initially, but after kind of dealing with her a little bit earlier in the chapter, I'm like, maybe it's not as much as I thought.
I don't really see him as the spiteful type.
No, I guess, and I don't really either. Culp is a pretty cool fella.
Yeah, and for better or worse, they are a party of three.
Yes.
I don't think he'd just hang her out to die. Because, you know, he does have some loyalty to Hebrick, at least making sure Hebrick is safe and makes it through. So she's important to Hebrick. Maybe there's a little bit of him wanting to not have something bad happen to her for Hebrick's sake.
Yeah, you're probably right.
The salve was cool and seemed to absorb Felicin's pain. Beneath its colorless patina, she saw her skin grow anew. Culp applied it where she could not reach, and half a bowl later, the last flare of agony was healed. Suddenly exhausted, Felicin sat down on the sand. That's some really powerful stuff.
Yeah. Is that magics or alchemies?
It might be a combination of both. Magic-infused alchemies.
Is there a difference due to... Because I've always found alchemies... Is that science trying to... I mean, sorry, I know it's not true, but is alchemy the idea of science trying to replicate magical stuff?
I always think of alchemy as a technological attempt at accomplishing the same thing as magic.
Okay, so that's kind of what I'm thinking too, like using science to duplicate that.
Yes.
To duplicate magic.
And what's the saying? Any sufficiently advanced technology would appear like magic to an uninitiated individual?
Yes.
Something along those lines?
Yes. You know, that's what's so great about this series. There's everything, dude. He's got everything. How does he do it, folks? He covers all grounds in one series. It's amazing.
It's just too good.
It is.
A broken-stemmed glass of wine appeared before her face. Nawal smiled down on her. He said, "This shall restore you, gentle lass. A pliant current will take the mind past suffering into life's most peaceful stream. Here, drink, my dear. I care for your well-being most deeply." She accepted the glass and demanded, "Why? Why do you care most deeply?" Nawal said, "A man of my wealth can offer you much, child. All that you grant of your free will is my reward. And no, I am most gentle." She downed a mouthful of the tart, cool wine and asked, "Are you now?" His nod was solemn, his eyes glittering between the folds of dimpled flesh. He said, "This I promise." Felicin thought, "Hood knows I could do worse. Riches and comfort, ease and indulgences, Durhang and wine, pillows to lie on." Nawal said, "I sense wisdom in you, my dear, so I shall not press. Let you, rather, yourself ascend to the proper course." Bedrolls had been laid out. One of the undead servants had fanned to life a camp stove, the remnants of one sleeve catching light and smoldering in the process, a detail none commented on. Yeah, these servants, they're thankful relief to the palpable tension in this scene.
And again, I'm always amazed at how he can always, Mr. Erickson can always bring levity, even to some of the darkest scenarios.
Darkness swiftly closed in around them. Noel commanded the lighting of lanterns and their positioning on poles situated in a circle around the camp. One of the corpses stood beside Felicin and refilled her glass after every mouthful. The creature's flesh looked gnawed. Gaping, bloodless wounds lined his pallid arms. All his teeth had fallen out. Felicin glanced up at him, willing herself against recoiling. She asked, "And how did you die?" The servant said, "Terribly." Felicin again asked, "But how?" The servant said, "I am forbidden to say more. I died terribly, a death to match one of Hood's own nightmares. It was long, yet swift, an eternity that passed in an instant. I was surprised, yet knowing. Small pain, yet great pain. The flood of darkness, yet blinding." Felicin cut the servant off and said, "All right, I see your master's point." The servant said, "So you shall." Mm. That's a bit ominous.
Yeah. I bet you could hear the soundtrack on the movie in my mind. At
yes.
this point, there's the swell of music. Like,
if filmed properly, the tension in the scene, you could cut the air with a knife.
Oh, absolutely.
Culp said, "Go easy on that, lass. Best have your wits about you." Felicin asked, "Why? It's not availed me yet, has it?" In defiance, she drained the glass and held it up to be refilled. Her head was swimming, her limbs seeming to float. The servant splashed wine over her hand. That's the Felicin we know.
Yes, and to be fair, though, she has been clean and sober for a little bit, and it would not take much of anything to put her over the edge here. I'm not trying to make an excuse for her, but because I don't think she has no excuse except for naivete. But that is the Felicin we know.
Yeah, I was thinking more from the perspective of her doing it just to spite Culp, who admittedly is only trying to watch out for her.
Yeah. Now, if she can't sense the tension here, and she apparently is oblivious to it. I mean, but I think she's at rest because Haborik said he didn't sense anything other than greed.
Yeah, but then why wouldn't she say her name? If that's the thing, right?
That's true.
Under the impression that she was, you know what it is? Maybe I thought she was being cautious. Maybe because of the salve, she thinks, it's not so bad. The guy healed her after all.
Right. Well, that's also what she even said it. He's not so bad. She said it herself.
Yeah.
Be riches, have what I want. She's thinking about it.
Noel had returned to his wide padded chair, watching the three of them with a contented smile on his lips. He wheezed, "Mortal company, such a difference. I am so much delighted. I need only bask in the mundane. Tell me, where do you seek to go? Whatever launched you on such a perilous journey? The rebellion? Is it truly as bloody as I have heard rumored? Such injustice is ever repaid in full. Alas, this lesson is lost, I am afraid." Felicin said, "We're going nowhere." Noel asked, "Might I convince you to revise your chosen destination then?" Felicin asked, "And you offer protection? How reliable? What happens if we run into bandits or worse?" Noel said, "No harm shall come to you, my dear. A man who deals in sorcery has many resorts in defense of selves. Not once in all my travels have I been beset by nefarious fools. Accosted on occasion, yes, but all have turned away when I gifted them wisdom. My dear, you are positively breathtaking. Your smooth, sun-honeyed skin is a balm to my eyes." Felicin murmured, "What would your wife say?" Noel said, "Alas, I am a widower. My dear has passed through the hooded one's gates almost a year ago to this day. Hers was a full, happy life, I am pleased to say, and that gives me great comfort. Ah, would that her spirit could arise and set you at ease with reassurances, my dear." Tapu skewers sizzled on the camp stove. Noel said, "Mage, you have opened your warren. Tell me, what do you see? Have I given you cause for mistrust?" Culp said, "No, merchant, and I see nothing untoward, yet the spells surrounding us are high castings. I am impressed." Noel said, "Only the best in protection of oneself, of course." The ground trembled suddenly, and something huge pushed a brown furred shoulder into the sphere opposite Felicin. The beast's shoulder was almost three arm lengths high. After a moment, the creature growled and withdrew. Noel exclaimed, "Beasts! They plague this desert! But fear not, none shall defeat my wards. I urge calm." Felicin thought, calm. I am very calm. We're finally safe. Nothing can reach us. Finger-long claws tore a swath down the sphere's blurry wall, a bellow of rage ripping forth to shiver the air. Noal surged upright with surprising speed. He yelled, back, damned one! Away! One thing at a time! Felicin blinked. She thought, one thing at a time? The sphere glowed as the jagged tears closed. The apparition beyond bellowed again, this time in what was clearly frustration. Claws tore another path, which healed even as it appeared. A body thundered against the barrier, withdrew, then tried again. Noal, his face dark with fury, cried, we are safe! It shall not succeed, no matter how stubborn. But still, how shall we sleep in such racket? Culp strode up to Noal, who unaccountably backed away a step. Culp then turned to face the determined intruder. He said, that's a soul taken, very strong. From where Felicin sat, all that followed appeared in a seamless flow, with something close to grace. As soon as Culp swung his back to the merchant, Noal seemed to blur beneath his silks, his skin deepening into glistening black fur. Sharp spice overpowered the citrus perfume in a hot gust. Rats poured forth, a growing flood. Grillin.
What a man. He's a rough one, too.
Yes,
he is. He's powerful.
Hebrick screamed a warning, but it was already too late. The rats flowed over Culp and swallowed him entirely in a seething cloak, not by the score, but in the hundreds. Culp's shriek was a dull muffle. A moment later, the mound of creatures seemed to buckle, their weight crushing Culp down. The four bears stood off to one side watching. Strangely not indeed. What a terrible way to go.
Yes, awful way to go. I'm reminded, have you ever seen The Bone Collector?
Yes.
That's one of the deaths in that, remember? Was a guy in the subway system under in between the walls or something like that, but he was tied to something so the rat and like cut in some places so he'd bleed and draw the rats to him.
Terrible.
Awful.
Hebrick plunged into the mass of rats, his ghost hands now glowing gauntlets of fire, one jade green, the other rust red. Rats flinched away. Each one he grasped burned into black, mangled flesh and bone. Yet the swarm spread outward, more and more of the silent creatures clambering over one another, heaving in waves over the ground. That would be another amazing visual, the glowing hands burning these rats to a crisp as he wades in there.
Yeah. Also, as he climbed on that cliff and with Felicin and Culp strapped to his back with using those hands, these are all amazing visuals. And I always feel like Erickson is one of, if not the best, author I've read at painting visuals in his stories of almost anybody.
It's a really good job of making the scene come to life in my mind.
Yes, very visual.
They dissipated from the place where Culp had lain. Felicin saw the flash of wet bones, a ragged rain cape. She could not comprehend its significance. R.I.P. Culp. He deserved better.
Yes, he did. Lots better. And a moment of silence, please. I really liked him.
Yeah.
But remember, folks, no one is safe in this series.
Is that the first real major character that we've had die that was one of the people that we followed and really liked?
Yes. Yeah, because we've lost one in a way, but she came back as something else. Silver Fox / Tattersail. I can't think of anyone else that was really that was someone that I cared about. It's snuffed it yet.
Okay, yeah.
Do we keep a count? Do we start the body count of people we like?
Oh, man. That'd get pretty hefty after a while, I think.
It's bad. Oh.
The soul taken beyond the wards was attacking the barrier in a frenzy. The torn wounds were slower in closing. A bear's paw and forearm, as wide around as Felicin's waist, plunged through the rent. The rats rose in a writhing crest to sweep down on Hebrick. Still screaming, he staggered back. A hand clutched Felicin's collar from behind and yanked her upright. A voice said, "Grab him and run, lass." Head spinning, she twisted around to find herself staring up into Bodden's weathered face. He held in his other hand four of the lanterns. "Get moving, damn you!" He pushed her hard toward Hebrick, who was still stumbling back, the tide seething in pursuit. Behind Hebrick, 2 tons of bear was pushing through the barrier. Man, Bodden.
Yes.
Heroically showing up when they need him.
Yes.
Baudin leapt past Hebrick, smashing one of the lanterns against the ground. Lamp oil sprayed in gushing streaks of flame. A furious scream erupted from the rats. The four servants broke into hacking laughter. The crest crashed over Baudin, but they could not drag him down as they had Culp. He swung the lanterns, shattering them. Fire leapt around him. A moment later, he and hundreds of rats were engulfed in flames. Felicin reached Hebrick, who was sheathed in blood from countless small wounds. His sightless eyes seemed focused on an inner horror that matched the scene before them. Grasping an arm, she pulled him to one side. Grillin's voice filled her mind. "Do not fear for yourself, my dear. Wealth and peace, every indulgence to sate your desires. And I am gentle to those I choose, oh so gentle." Felicin hesitated. The voice went on, "Leave me to this hard-skinned stranger and the old man. Then I shall deal with Mesrim, that foul, most rude soul-taken who so dislikes me." What a convergence this has turned out to be. We met Mesrim at the beginning of the book.
Yeah, it was Mesrim. He encountered Akarim and Mappo, right?
They met Mesrim when they got to Tessim.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Where Iskarl Pust is, yeah.
Yeah, he came up and started talking to him like a buddy almost. He's a little off, but he was very cordial.
Right. Mappo knew him, and Akarim was still a little wary.
Yeah.
Yet Felicin heard pain in Grillin's words, an edge of desperation. The soul taken was sundering the barrier, its hungry roar deafening in its reverberations. Baudin would not fall. He killed rat after rat, all within a shroud of flame, yet they surged over him in ever-growing numbers, the sheer mass of bodies smothering the burning oil. Felicin glanced at Mesrim, gauging its awesome power, its fearless rage. She shook her head and said, "No, you're in trouble, divers." She took hold of Hebrick once again and dragged him to the dying barrier. The voice in her head said, "My dear, wait! Oh, you stubborn mortal, why won't you die?" Felicin could not help but grin. She thought, "That won't work. I should know." The whirlwind had begun its own assault against the sphere. Wind-whipped sand rasped against her face. Hebrick gasped, "Wait, Culp!" Cold gripped Felicin. She thought, "He's dead. Oh gods, he's dead. Devoured, and I watched, drunk and uncaring, noticing nothing. One thing at a time. Culp's dead." She bit back a sob, pushed the ex-priest into, then through the barrier, even as it finally collapsed. Mesrim's roar of triumph announced its surging charge into the midst of the rats. Felicin did not turn to watch the attack, did not turn to discover Baudin's fate. Dragging Hebrick, she ran into the dusk-darkened storm. Couple of things here. Baudin is such a beast. He climbed down that same cliff through the storm as them without any protection, and he ran in without pause to fight Grillin with those lanterns. It's just amazing.
Yeah, total beast. But Baudin was awesome, dude.
Also, Felicin actually showed some emotion at the loss of Culp. It's a little surprising given how she treated him while he was alive.
Yes, and this could also be a couple of different things. You know, it's like you mentioned, they're a party of three and have been for a little bit. So, and we're have been bigger and smaller party, but at the same time, he's been with them for a little bit. And to lose a traveling companion, like him or not, is kind of shows you that, holy crap, that could have been me.
Right.
And so there is that. But that's all I got. I do like seeing her. I feel like this chapter we see a little, maybe I'm hoping it's honest growth from her.
Felicin and Hebrick did not get far. The sandstorm's fury battered them, pushed them, finally drove them into the frail shelter offered by an overhanging spur of rock. They collapsed at its base, huddling together, awaiting death. The alcohol in Felicin pulled her down into sleep. She thought to resist it, then surrendered, telling herself that the horror would soon find them, and to witness her own death offered no comfort. She thought, "I should tell Hebrick the true worth of knowledge now, yet he will learn that himself. Not long, not long at all." She awoke to silence, but no, not silence. Someone nearby was weeping. Felicin opened her eyes. The whirlwind storm had ceased. The sky overhead was a golden shroud of suspended dust. It was so thick on all sides that she could see no more than half a dozen paces. Yet the air was still. She thought, "Gods, the divers is back." But no, the calm was everywhere. Head aching and mouth painfully dry, she sat up. Hebrick knelt a few paces away, vague behind a haze. Invisible hands were pressed against his face, pulling the skin into bizarre folds, as if he was wearing a grotesque mask. His whole body heaved with grief, and he rocked back and forth with dull, senseless repetition. Memory flooded Felicin. Culp. She felt her own face twisting. She croaked, "He should have sensed something." Hebrick's head shot up, his sightless eyes red and hooded as they fixed on her. He asked, "What?" Felicin snapped, "The mage! The bastard was a diver's. He should have known." Hebrick said, "Gods, girl, would that I had your armor." Felicin thought, "And should I bleed within it? You see nothing, old man. No one shall see. No one shall know." After a moment, Hebrick said, "If I had, I would be able to stay at your side, to offer what protection I could, though wondering why I bothered. Granted, yet I would." Felicin asked, "What are you babbling about?" Hebrick said, "I am fevered. The divers has poisoned me, lass, and it wars with the other strangers in my soul. I do not know if I shall survive this, Felicin." She barely heard him. Her attention had been pulled away by a scuffing sound. Someone was approaching, haltingly, a stagger and a scrape of pebbles. Felicin pushed herself to her feet and faced the sound. Hebrick fell silent, his head cocked. The figure that emerged from the ochre mist sank talons into her sanity. She heard a whimper from her own throat. Bodden was burned, gnawed, parts completely eaten away. He had been charred down to the bone in places, and the heat had swelled the gases in his belly, bloating him until he looked with child. The skin and flesh cracked open. There was nothing left of his features except ragged holes where his eyes, nose, and mouth should have been. Yet Felicin knew it was him. That's such a horrible image.
Well, absolutely horrific image, yes.
Something about burned victims always gets me. It's a rough one.
It is. It's hard. I feel so bad for them too, for folks to get so burned up like that.
Yeah. Bodden staggered another step closer, then slowly sank down to the ground. Hebrick demanded, "What is it? This time I'm truly blind. Who has come?" After a long moment, Felicin said, "No one." She walked slowly to the thing that had once been Bodden. She sank down into the warm sand, reached out and lifted his head, cradled it on her thighs. He was aware of her, reaching up an encrusted, fused hand to hover a moment near her elbow before falling back. He spoke, each word like rope on rock. "I thought, the fire, immune." She whispered, "You were wrong." An image of armor within her suddenly cracking, fissures spreading, and beneath it, behind it, something was building. Bodden said, "My vow." She said, "Your vow." Bodden said, "Your sister." Felicin said, "Tavora." Bodden said, "She..." Felicin interrupted, "Don't. No, Bodden. Say nothing of her." He drew a ragged breath and said, "You." Felicin waited, hoping the life would flee this husk. Flee it now, before. Bodden said, "You were not what I expected." Armor can hide anything until the moment it falls away. Even a child, especially a child. Man, that's a tough scene. Really, really tough. Seeing these cracks form in Felicin's armor is some interesting character development.
I agree. I'm hoping that this is, you know, this is what I was alluding to earlier. You know, we've seen her do this before where she seems to show some bit of growth and then she steps back and she comes back even saltier and nastier than ever. But this chapter, there seems to have been something, some of her anger seems to have dissipated a little bit. But man, this is a tough chapter already just because we just lost two people we like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not even two pages, three
in
pages.
The span of two pages, man. Yeah. I can't take anymore. Don't do
this. Like, I know. It's like, stop, man. It's like, it's just not anymore for a little bit. Give us a few pages of rest, man. Come on.
Yeah. I still don't know what kind of vow he gave to Vora that would make him go through that. I mean, what could you say to somebody that would make you do that for somebody?
Is it just expected out of someone that was a Talon? I mean, is it just their word means that or
his
something?
His dad was a Talon. He wasn't a Talon. He inherited it from his dad.
That's true. And what's bad is I don't know because we'll never know. We'll never know.
Yeah. It blows my mind because he's a rough guy. Yeah. He's not the heroic type. But then you look at the sacrifices he makes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because our first introduction to him is him using a chain to remove a woman's head. Dude. In the prologue, and then there's, you know, and then we see him go through all this difficulty for Felicin, and apparently he's been, this whole time they've been alone, he's been on their trail, keeping his eyes on her and making sure she's okay. I mean, yeah. I don't know. I'm curious. I'm really curious about him.
Yeah.
He's as tough and as hard as any of these other people that we like so much in this series.
I agree. We should ask Mr. Erickson. He might not have anything for us, but I keep coming back to this question of what could Tavora have said to him that would make him go through that for her?
Unless it's just one of these horrifically cold things. I couldn't see Tavora. And now I don't know her yet, but unless she threatened his entire family, I can't imagine what would make, but this is not done out of a fear. I never feel that this is done. I feel this is the most assuredly loyalty. That's how I feel, at least.
Agreed. A sense of honor.
Yeah. His word given, I'm going to do it no matter what.
Right. We go to Fiddler and Company. There was nothing to distinguish sky from earth. Gold stillness had embraced the world. Stones pattered down the trail as Fiddler pulled himself onto the crest, the clatter appallingly loud to his ears. He thought, she's drawn breath and waits. And she being the whirlwind goddess, the storm has subsided for the time being. Fiddler wiped sweaty dust from his brow. He thought, Hood's breath, this bodes ill. Mappo emerged from the haze ahead. Exhaustion made his walk more of a shamble than usual. His eyes were red-rimmed. The lines that bracketed his prominent canines were deeply etched into his weathered skin. Mappo said, the trail winds ever onward. I believe she's with her father now. They walk together. Fiddler. Fiddler said, I, the whirlwind goddess. Mappo said, there is expectancy in the air. Fiddler grunted at the understatement. After a moment, Mappo sighed. Well, let us join the others. Ikarium had found a flat stretch of rock surrounded by large boulders. Crocus sat with his back against stone, watching Ikarium lay out foodstuffs in the center. The expression Crocus wore as Fiddler arrived belonged to a much older man. Crocus said, she's not turning back. Fiddler said nothing, unslinging his crossbow and setting it down. Ikarium cleared his throat and said, come and eat, lad. The realms are overlapping, and all is possible, including the unexpected. Distress over what has not yet happened avails you nothing. In the meantime, the body demands sustenance, and it will do none of us any good if you've no reserves of energy when comes the time to act. This quote, distress over what has not yet happened avails you nothing, is one I had highlighted and is particularly impactful to me. It helps to remember this when you're getting worked up over some outcome that's yet to materialize.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's funny because the Bible actually says this. Talk about being anxious for nothing, but, you know, ask for everything in prayer. And to translate in a more modern translation that's more of a paraphrase, that has been translated literally into worry about nothing, pray about everything. And yes, I too had this highlighted, but I think it's kind of funny because I was reading this before I actually read the Bible. And I thought it's kind of funny how it's like, wow, there's multiple mentions in the Bible about, dude, don't worry about it. Worrying about things that you ain't promised, because it's worrying about tomorrow. Tomorrow's not even promised. So deal with what you got on your plate right now.
Mm-hmm. So it kind of forces an optimism, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So instead of worrying about it, you're hoping for the better outcome by praying.
Well you are, because the fact is that regardless of how awful our outcomes are as believers, because the ultimate goal is to initially be with him in the end. So if the ultimate outcome is worse than it's enough to kill me, well, then it's all the better. I'm not looking to be killed anytime soon. I'm enjoying my life on this earth because this is all I know. But there is an expectation of greater things to come. So it does take a lot of the worry out of it. And some of us are just geared that way. I think a lot has to do with how you're raised. My mother and father were so good about not sharing information with us. And you know what I'm talking about. The things that, you know, so many children sometimes are exposed to worries in their household finances or things like this. They have honestly no business being involved in, because they worry overly about things. And I and my parents were really good about not worrying about things that I saw. Mm-hmm. I know they worried, but I didn't see it. You know,
mm-hmm.
Very appreciated. It's very much appreciated.
Yeah. It's good to shield them from, especially like any financial stress or anything like that. Yeah. They don't need to know about that.
Let them be kids. That's right. Let kids be kids, man.
I wanted to come back to this quote Because when we were talking earlier about having a viewpoint like Felicin's, where it's all for nothing and it just feels like there's no point to any of it, I kind of felt like this ties in a little bit to that.
Just a Lebowski there for a second.
We believe in nothing, Lebowski.
It's going to say, it's okay, Donnie, these guys are nihilists. It's like, oh, she's a nihilist, dude. That's what's
okay.
I'm so sorry. Oh, you. Yeah. What's great is that you pre-guessed where I was going with this. It's like we believe in nothing, Lebowski. Brilliant, sir. Brilliant.
All right, that's good. Crocus muttered, "It's already too late," but he clambered to his feet nonetheless. Ikarium said, "There is too much mystery in this path to be certain of anything. Twice we have traveled warrens. Their aspects I cannot say. They felt ancient and fragmented, woven into the very rock of Uraku. At one point I smelled the sea," Mappo said, "as did I." He shrugged. Crocus said, "More and more her journey takes attack where such things as rebirth become more probable. I am right in that, aren't I?" Ikarium said, "Perhaps. Yet this pensive air hints at uncertainty as well, Crocus. Be mindful of that." Mappo said, "Apsalar is not seeking to flee us. She is leading us. What significance should we place in that? With her godly gifts, she could easily mask her trail. That shadow wrought residue that, to Ikarium and to myself, is as plain and undisguised as an imperial road." Fiddler muttered, "There might be something else besides." He drew a deep breath, let it out slowly, and continued, "The last knows our intent, Crocus. What Kalam and I had planned and what is still, as far as I know, being followed. She could well have taken the notion that by assuming the guise of Shaik, she can, indirectly, support our efforts, in a manner wholly her own rather than that of the god who once possessed her." Mappo smiled wryly. He said, "There's much you've held from myself and Ikarium, soldier." Fiddler said, "An imperial matter." He didn't meet Mappo's eyes. Mappo said, "Yet one that sees advantage in this land's rebellion." Fiddler said, "Only in the short run, Mappo." Mappo said, "In becoming Shaik reborn, Apsalar will not simply be engaging in a change of costume, Fiddler. The cause of the goddess will take hold of Apsalar's mind, her soul. Such visions and visitations will change her." Fiddler said, "She may not realize that particular possibility, I'm afraid." Crocus snapped, "She's not a fool!" Fiddler replied, "I'm not saying she is. Like it or not, Apsalar possesses something of a god's arrogance. I was witness to the full force of that back on Genabacus, and I can see that its stain still resides within her. Consider her present decision to leave Iskarel's temple alone in pursuit of her father." Mappo said, "In other words, you think she might believe she can withstand the influence of the goddess, even as she assumes the role of prophetess and war leader?" I could see how she'd come to this conclusion, given she was able to withstand the possession by the rope initially. The only problem is, I'm not sure Apsalar knows anything about Riga protecting her while she was originally possessed.
Did she withstand the rope's possession? Because when he was in there, he seemed to ride her like a rented mule. She seemed to only be free when the rope was forcibly vacated by Rake's interaction with Shadowthrone, right?
What I mean by her surviving intact is, she is herself now.
I'm operating
under the assumption that if Riga had not protected her mind, her sanity would be gone.
Oh, she would just be like a husk, just a brain dead kind of person, or
either that or would have just died outright.
Probably so. Okay. I see your point. You're correct.
Also, when Mallet was working on Apsalar, didn't he allow Riga's presence to do what it wanted as part of her healing? Because I think Mallet told Perrin that he felt that it was trying to help in some way. Do you remember that?
I think you're right on that. But that begs another question to my mind. Is Apsalar Riga one person versus being Apsalar and Riga in one? They're now just kind of one mind, an amalgam?
That's a good question. I don't know exactly what Riga's influence was there, because that would be pretty selfless for her to just sacrifice herself entirely just to save the girl. Possible. Potentially.
Yeah.
But she seemed crafty. She was also enslaving souls.
Yeah.
So there's a possibility that she looked at this as a way of continuing her life. She knew she was going to die there.
Yeah, that's a good call. Yeah, that's a good way of seeing it too. It was a way for her to kind of... You see Being John Malkovich?
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, okay. There's a point where that's the idea of what these things are. You know what it's about? Have I mentioned it?
there's a door to his mind, right? I don't know much else about what's going on there.
Yes, and spoiler alert, people, spoiler alert, if you've not seen the film. Okay, I've given you time. The spoiler alert is this, is that Malkovich is himself a vessel for a group of individuals to ride to the next body so they can live on inside of him.
Oh, wow.
So you got to see it, dude. It's real twisted.
Okay.
It's fantastic.
So back to the point about Riga and Absalar and what level of influence she has over her, unknown. Don't know if she's even in there anymore.
Dude, we've had a lot of unknowns. This is a lot of unknowns.
It is.
And I'm not upset by this because there's just still so much going on. It's like, you know what? There's still a lot more to deal with. I'm not worried about that.
Just ride the wave. We'll get there eventually.
Yeah, that's right.
Krogus scowled. My mind's tumbling from one thing to the next. What if the patron god of assassins has reclaimed her? What will it mean if the rebellion is suddenly led by Cotillion and, by extension, Amanus? The dead emperor returns to wreak vengeance. There was silence. Fiddler had been gnawing on that possibility like an obsessed hound since it had occurred to him days earlier. That's a pretty creative way of putting that sentence.
Yes, it is.
I like that.
Creative. I like it too.
Yeah, we've had a cat analogy once already, and now we got the dog
analogy. Cats and dogs.
The notion of a murdered emperor turned ascendant, suddenly reaching out from the shadows to reclaim the imperial throne, was anything but a pleasant prospect. It was one thing seeking to assassinate Lassine. That was, in the end, a mortal affair. Gods ruling a mortal empire, on the other hand, would draw other ascendants, and in such a contest, entire civilizations would be destroyed. They finished their meal in silence. The dust filling the air refused to settle. It simply hung motionless. Ikariam repacked the supplies. Fiddler strode over to Krogus and said, "No value in fretting, lad. She's found her father. After all these years, there's something to be said for that, don't you think?" Crocus's smile was wry. He said, "Oh, I've thought on that, Fid, and yes, I am happy for her, yet mistrustful. What should have been a wondrous reunion has been compromised by a Scarl Pust, by Shadow's manipulation. It's soured everything." Fiddler said, "However you may have envisioned it, Krokus, it belongs to Absalar." Krokus was silent for a long minute, then he nodded. Fiddler retrieved his crossbow and slung it over one shoulder. He said, "At the very least, we've had a respite from Shaik's soldiers and the divers and Soul Taken." Krokus asked, "Where is she leading us, Fid?" Fiddler shrugged and said, "I suspect we'll find that out soon enough." We are taken somewhere else in Raraku. The weathered man stood on the hump of rock facing the holy desert. The silence was absolute. He could hear his own heart, a steady, mindless rhythm in his chest. It had begun to haunt him. Rocks skittered at his back, and a moment later the Toblakai appeared, dropping a brace of arm-long lizards onto the bleached bedrock. The Toblakai rumbled, "Everything's come out for a look around. For once, a meal worth eating." Witness.
Success.
The Toblakai was gaunt. His rages of impatience were gone, and Leoman was thankful for that, though he well knew that a withering of strength was the cause. A few days prior, when the whirlwind had renewed itself in a frenzy, Toblakai had whispered, "We wait until Hood comes to take us." Leoman had had no answer to that. His faith was in tatters. Shaik's wrapped corpse still lay between the wind-sculpted stone gateposts. It had shrunk. The tent cloth shroud had frayed in the ceaseless clawing wind. The dry knobs of her joints protruded through the worn weave. Her hair, which had continued to grow for weeks, had been pulled free and whipped endlessly in the storm. That's a pretty wild image, with all the hair blowing around the desiccated corpse.
Yeah, I got a very anime image in my mind for hair, because you know the hair in anime. Mm-hmm. It is an entity unto itself usually. So yeah, I could see the hair just whipping around and continue growing for weeks afterwards. Very strange.
Isn't that what normally happens?
I thought it wasn't technically a matter of the hair growing. I thought what happened is that the skin retracted and dried out and exposed more of the hair and the nails. Like some of it grows a little bit, but not for weeks, I didn't think. I thought it was a matter of like hours or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I thought they continued to grow, but I don't have any confirmation of that.
Yeah, nor I.
Yet now a change had come. The whirlwind held its immortal breath. The desert, which had been lifted entire from its bones of rock, filling the air, refused to settle. The Toblakai saw this as the whirlwind's death. Shaik's murder had triggered a prolonged tantrum, a defeated goddess rampaging in frustration and fury. Even as the rebellion spread its bloody cloak over seven cities, its heart was dead. The armies of the apocalypse were the still twitching limbs on a corpse. Leoman, plagued with hunger-borne visions and fevers, had begun a slow stumbling toward the same belief. Yet. The Toblachai said, "This meal will give us the strength needed, Leoman." Leoman thought, "For leaving. And where do we go? To the oasis in the center of Raraku, where a dead woman's army still waits? Are we the chosen deliverers of the news of tragic failure, or do we abandon them, set off for Panpatsin, then on to Erlitan, in a flight into anonymity?" Leoman turned. His gaze traveled over the ground and came to rest on the Book of Dryzhna, where it waited, unmarred by the whirlwind, immune even to the dust that found its way into everything. He thought, "The power abides, unquenched. When I look upon that tome, I know I cannot let go. Blades in hand and unhanded in wisdom, young yet old, one life whole, another incomplete, she shall emerge renewed." Quick reminder, this is a quote from Shaikh earlier in the book. Did still hidden truths remain within those words? Had Leoman's imagination, his willful yearning, betrayed him? The Toblachai squatted before the dead lizards, flipped the first one onto its back, and set a knife blade to its belly. He said, "I would go west, into the Jagodon." Leoman glanced over. He thought, "The Jagodon, there to come face to face with other giants, the Jag themselves, the Trell, more savages. The lad will feel right at home in that wasteland." That sounds delightful to us mortals.
Right?
Sounds like some barbaric ancient land.
Yeah, it sounds like its own gauntlet.
Yeah. Leoman said, "This is not over." The Toblachai bared his teeth, a hand plunging through the slit in the lizard's belly to reemerge with slick entrails. He said, "This one's female. It's said the roe is good for fevers, isn't it?" Leoman said, "I am not fevered." The Toblachai said nothing, but Leoman saw a new set to his shoulders. He had made a decision. Leoman said, "Take what's left of your kill. You'll need it more than I." The Toblachai said, "You jest, Leoman. You do not see yourself as I see you. You are skin on bones. You have devoured your own muscles. I see the skull behind the face when I look at you." Leoman said, "I am clear of mine nonetheless." The Toblachai grunted. A hale man would not say so with such certainty. Is that not the secret revelation of Raraku? Madness is simply a state of mind. Leoman muttered, "The sayings of the fool are aptly named," his voice falling away. A charge was filling the hot, motionless air. Leoman felt his heartbeat faster, harder. The Toblachai straightened, his huge hands smeared with blood. The two men slowly turned to face the ancient gate. The black hair emerging from the bundled corpse stirred, the strands gently lifting. The suspended dust had begun to swirl beyond the pillars. Sparks winked in the midst, like jewels set in an ochre cloak. The Toblachai asked, "What?" Leoman glanced over at the holy book. Its hide cover glistened as if with sweat. He took a step toward the gate. Something was emerging from the dust cloud. Two figures, side by side, their arms locked around one another, staggering, heading straight toward the pillars, and the corpse lying between the bleached gateposts. Leoman thought, "Blades in hand and unhanded in wisdom." One was an old man, the other a young woman. Heart hammering in his chest, Leoman let his gaze fix on her. So alike. Dark threat pours from her. Pain. And from pain, rage. There was a thump and a grate of stones beside Leoman. He turned to see the Toblachai on his knees, head bowed before the approaching apparitions. Now that is interesting. He kneels for her?
I agree. That is interesting. I did not remember that.
Yeah. Who does this guy kneel for? Ever.
This must be the last.
The last time it ever happens. Raising her head, the woman found first Shaikh's rapt course, then lifted her eyes higher to fix on Leoman and the kneeling giant. She halted, almost standing over the body, her long black hair rising as if with a static charge. Leoman thought, younger, yet the fire within, it's the same. Ah, my faith. Leoman lowered himself to one knee and said, "You are reborn." The woman's low laugh was triumphant. She said, "So I am."
What? Did her Bene Gesserit training kicking in? She's using the prophecy from the Orange Catholic Bible to aid her here.
She shifted her grip on the old man, whose head hung low, his clothes nothing but rags. She commanded, "Help me with him. but beware his hands. Beware his hands? What could that mean? We'll find out soon.
Yep.
And thus the chapter ends.
Wow.
Oh, man. That was quite eventful. For standout moments, Hebrick's ability to hold the weight of all three of them and climb the cliff face was extremely impressive.
Oh, very, very impressive. Major core memory for that. And I always like the superhuman feats in these books because there's buku. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of outrageous adventures that go on in here. That's merely a simple one, but it sticks with me. This guy's got no hands.
He's literally reaching into rock and gripping invisible handholds.
Yeah, that's wild, man.
The ferocity of the storm as they climbed down and its effect on Felicin's skin was savage.
Yeah. The way that peeled her skin off is so trippy to me, too. It's just because she talks about it. She doesn't mention it being painful, just like a cat's tongue rasping as it slowly peels her skin away.
Man. The tension in the scene leading up to Grillin changing into rat form was palpable.
Oh, my word. Very. Especially with that last remark by that one guy says something about you will. You'll understand soon enough. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of comments. Very ominous.
Yeah. And the undead, I appreciated the tone they set. You know, it was a little humorous, even though it was a very tense scene.
Yeah. Very nice.
Hebrick wading into the rats with glowing hands to save Culp.
It's such a cool visual, dude, isn't it?
Yeah, just and then them just lighting on fire every time he grasps one.
I'm imagining red and green fire.
Oh, yeah. That'd be super cool.
Yeah.
Just turning them into ashes in his hands.
Yeah. And think about, I don't know, do we know if Grillin, does Grillin ever show back up?
I don't remember.
If he survived it, he'll be weaker.
Yeah. It takes time to regenerate the extra bodies.
Yeah. He lost quite a few bodies in that one.
Oh, yeah. It's hard to say how many. And I think it's interesting that Mesrim was willing to go in there because as big as he is, I'm imagining thousands of rats.
That's what I'm thinking. I was thinking thousands as well.
I can't imagine how Mesrim would be able to take them out just by himself. I mean, sure, you could trample some and bite some, but he's going to get bitten himself.
He must not care. Mesrim's just got to be – Mesrim has to be a much tougher individual to have been – you know, I say that tougher. I don't know. I'm not sure if he was tougher, if it had been a fight of equals, but seeing as how it is the mad, mad, mad race of this world, I'm assuming that Mesrim's like, you know, I got to take – anyone I encounter, I'm going to take out so it's somebody less later I have to see or fight or deal with. So that may be what it is.
Yeah. Felicin's reaction to Culp dying, that was – surprising to me.
Yeah, very surprising. And such a shame to lose Culp.
Yes.
I really liked him a lot. I forgot how cool he was.
His sarcasm was the best.
Oh my word. Fantastic sarcasm. Masterful. Boat repair Warren.
That's like one of the first times we met him.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Baudin appearing from nowhere and sacrificing himself to save Felicin.
Yeah, real powerful stuff there. Another core memory, Baudin. I mean, just tough stuff there too.
Yeah. That horrific scene where he walks out of the sand and he's burned to a crisp, bones here and there. Some of his parts are missing. It's horrible. And then seeing Felicin's reaction to that armor breaking a little bit, that was pretty tough to get through.
Yeah, very tough to get through. Unexpected from her. Quite touching, actually. And seeing Felicin hopefully become a better rounded character.
Yeah. Finally, Shaik being reborn.
Yeah. Now, is this Shaik or is this the, shall we say, the donor person that is somebody exploiting knowledge here for their benefit to kind of save their skin? Or is this, in fact, Shaik, I guess is my question. I guess it is. Got Toba Khan on his knees.
We can't really say much right now.
Yeah.
All right, Billy. Great job tonight.
Hey, great job, man.
Yeah.
Great chapter.
Yeah, great chapter.
This was for a chapter that was not, shall we say, as dense as some other ones, and it was not nearly as busy, it's still action-packed. And two big deaths.
Yes.
Culp and Baudin. I mean, dude, that's not easy.
Yeah. So,
but that's part of what makes, in my opinion, part of what makes Erickson's writing so fantastic, is people always being safe can sometimes ruin things. having skin in the game and have people that you lose that you like makes it that much of a better read.
Yeah. And then your reaction to them when they do go kind of makes you realize, oh, I really like that character. Sometimes in some books, somebody dies, you're like, eh, okay.
Yeah.
Big deal.
Exactly. So what? It's like, okay, I didn't like that guy anyhow.
Yeah. Sometimes they really hurt.
Yeah.
A lot of times they really hurt. Goes to show how good he is at writing really likable characters.
Yeah. Very good. Amazing.
Are you got any final thoughts before we drop off here?
No, I think that's it, man. Just, okay. I'm just excited about getting there.
Yeah. We're getting there.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
See y'all next week.
We thank you all for joining us today.
Again, we'd really like to thank you for taking the time to be with us, and we've had a really great time talking about the topic today.
If you would like to support our show, you can find us at horsefrogproductions.com, where you can find our Patreon link. Depending on the platform you're listening from, it may also be in the episode description.
And if you'd like to contact us through email, it's at contact@horsefrogproductions.com.